Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
This summer, discover American Giant's timeless, high-quality clothing made right here in the USA. Every piece is designed for quality and style that's built to last. From vintage-style tees to tough tank tops, breathable polos to lightweight sweatshirts, you can find your perfect fit. Celebrate American craftsmanship and support local communities with every stitch. Go to American-Giant.com and use promo code STAPLE20 for 20% off your first order.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Tuesday, May 14th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, I'm going to present an interview that I did with Dune Part 2 cinematographer Greg Fraser. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I wanted to talk to you guys today about one of my favorite movies of the year, which is Denis Villeneuve's Dune Part 2. This film features some of the best action scenes in recent memory. I just rewatched the scene where Timothée Chalamet's Paul Atreides rides the sandworm for the first time, and it is so good that it gave me chills. And this film also has a lot on its mind. It is a bleak look at how religion can be harnessed as a means of control, and how even those people with seemingly righteous ideals can become corrupted by power. It is also one of the most beautifully shot blockbusters that you are likely to ever see, and a huge part of the reason for that is because of Greg Fraser, who is unquestionably one of the best directors of photography working in Hollywood right now. He won an Oscar for his work on Dune Part 1, and some of his credits include Matt Reeves' The Batman, Catherine Bigelow's Zero Dark Thirty, Andrew Dominik's Killing Them Softly, and he's worked a couple times with Gareth Edwards, both on The Creator and Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. In addition, he is one of the key creative architects of stagecraft technology, also known as the volume. We've thrown this term around a lot on the podcast, but for new listeners who may not be aware, the volume is a gigantic LED soundstage that projects digital environments behind the actors, and it's linked to the camera in such a way that you can move the camera around and the LED walls update in real time to maintain the proper perspective. Crucially, it also provides lighting that can interact with the subjects, and when done well, it can appear seamless. This tech has been heavily used on the Star Wars shows on Disney+, most notably on The Mandalorian, which counted Fraser among its co-producers. When you hear stories of filmmakers becoming as interested in a piece of technology as Fraser has here, sometimes that interest turns to obsession, and people basically put on blinders and really don't want to do anything else. But despite being in on the ground floor of the volume and obviously finding it helpful to the process of certain projects, thankfully Fraser has not gone into full-blown obsession mode and devoted his entire career to only exploring that one thing. For example, he has said elsewhere that Dune Part 2 did not use the volume at all. I'm personally thrilled that his interests are versatile enough where he can play around in those waters when needed, but also understand that not every single project will actually benefit from that technology. Anyway, all of this to say, this guy is quickly approaching living legend status, so I jumped at the chance to talk to him a couple weeks ago in advance of today's 4K release of Dune Part 2, which I'm very excited about. It's an incredible disc. We talk about a few specific scenes in details here, so I would recommend checking out this movie and then coming back to listen to this conversation. The only other thing to know is that at one point he quickly mentions taking photos for the book that he did with Josh, And he's referencing Dune Exposures, which is a collaboration between Greg and actor Josh Brolin. It's a mixture of Greg's photography from the set of both Dune films, as well as Brolin's writing detailing his experiences making the movie. And that book is on sale right now if you want to check that out. Okay, that is enough table setting. Here is my conversation with Dune Part 2 cinematographer Greg Fraser. Hi, Greg. How are you?
Good, man. Very good. Good to talk to you, dude.
Excellent. I'm so thrilled to talk to you. I want to just dive in with the opening of Dune Part 2. So the opening Harkonnen attack in this movie takes place during an eclipse, and the lighting is extraordinary and looks different than it does at really any other time in the movie. And I understand that you didn't use the volume at all on this film, but I was wondering how you went about creating the lighting for that scene.
It's a good question because I haven't spoken a lot about it. The backstory is we were talking, Denis and I were talking about how to open the movie, and we talked about doing it at night. We talked about doing it day for night. We talked about it during day, and all those things just didn't sit well. We just went, this is not, you know, we put ourselves in the audience's seat and went, okay, we bought the popcorn, we're drinking the Coca-Cola, like, come on, you got to show us what you got, guys. Like, and we thought, well, if we start the same way that the last one finished, with that look, it felt a little bit not right, you know? So we were playing with all those different things. And, you know, I found a filter that kind of cuts out a number of light rays. I've been playing with particularly Getty Prime, but with infrared and cutting out red, green, and blues and cutting out spectrums of light to come up with different looks. And that's effectively what filters do. Filters cut a lot of spectrums of light. But I had a variable filter which took out just enough blue that you could get a little bit of blue in the sky, but it was mostly orangey or red, or it had the right element of shadow detail. And so we chose to use this filter, and we chose to kind of make it deeper and darker as the story went on, and as the, you know, eclipse became more heavy. And so we started that way because we knew it was a great way to start the film and a great way to kind of launch this journey. And also the Harkonnen, seeing those Harkonnen with those fantastic suits, you know, with their voices and their anti-gravity, and like seeing all that stuff in that color, I don't know, that's peak sci-fi for me. Like, yeah, that's the sci-fi I remember as a kid watching, you know, just like, you know, there's cool synthesizers and like, I love that sort of sci-fi.
Yeah, even just the anti-gravity thing, which is, I imagine, is like a pretty simple just use of wire rigs and stuff to get those performers to look that way, took my breath away watching the movie. So you guys really achieved your goal there of starting to have a strong foot.
Technically, let me just say, and I'll give full credit and full praise for the teams that were involved in doing all those shots and all that wire work. That is incredible work. It's not easy to do that level of that level of stuff. Yeah, it's not easy at all.
So speaking of things that are not easy to achieve, I watched one of the behind the scenes featurettes on the home video version of Dune Part 2, and it is all about the making of the sandworm riding scenes in this movie. Mm. And it seemed like you delegated a lot of that to a unit that was devoted specifically to executing the vision for those scenes. And I know they spent several weeks on that. So I'm curious if you could just walk me through what an average day looked like in the middle of production for you on this movie. Are you talking to that unit while setting up a different scene yourself? And like, what did a regular day look like from your perspective?
It's a good question. I haven't ever spoken about that because it was crazy. Yes. So what would happen is we would have multiple units going at once. Like we had Aaliyah being shot in a tank. You know, the models of Aaliyah. If Aaliyah wasn't being shot and being set up, we'd be shooting and setting up stuff on the worm outside. We'd be doing inserts of flashbacks of the Bene Gesserit, you know, mothers that came before. Like, there were things going on everywhere, and so for me, overseeing that, it was kind of like I had monitors with feeds to all these other units going on, and communication either via text message or via comms or whatever. And so it was making sure that everybody that was shooting those things were empowered to do it the best they could, but didn't accept or move on until they were properly shot. So Denis would also be viewing those as well. But I remember there was a day I walked out of one stage and I was walking to another stage, and it felt like a cliche of a movie scene you see in a movie where there's lots of shooting going on around the studio. You're walking with a character, and there's a guy on a sandworm with a wind machine floating, and then there's another explosion test going on over there, and there's another, guy eating a craft service. Like it was like a cliche of a movie set, because there was so much going on in the studio at once. And as the director of photography, I had to be all over every single one of those images, and entrust other teams to be able to kind of deliver those and roll on those, but still be knowing that it had to fit into the bigger picture of what we were making.
Like personality-wise, is that difficult for you? Because like DPs, I imagine I always think of them as, people being in full control of every single aspect of the visuals of a movie. And for you to be able to delegate that much to all these different units, I'm just curious, like personality-wise, was that something that was easy for you to do?
I've gotten better at it as I've gotten older, I can tell you that, because when I was younger, I had my try to have my fingers on everything. Whereas now I know that sometimes the best use of my time isn't necessarily standing waiting for 3 hours whilst they rig up a new explosion or a new position for the worm, or do you know what I mean? So the best use of my time at that point in time was potentially not watching them rig up a new position for 3 hours. It was working on the scene that we're working on, let's say in the water of life scene on another stage. And then, between takes, when Denise talking to actors, I could be looking at what they're doing. In some ways, actually, and also what it allowed my brain is to stay constantly active visually. And I was also taking stills as well for the book that I did with Josh. So it felt like my days were filled with images. Like I got home, the last thing I wanted to do was to watch any movies or anything. I was beat. My visual cortex was like literally steaming every time I got home. It was like overloaded.
Story-wise, in this movie, Paul essentially becomes something of a villain over the course of the film. And I was wondering if there were any techniques that you utilized over the course of the movie, whether it be a lens choice or a lighting cue or anything like that, to sort of subtly communicate to the audience that they weren't necessarily supposed to be rooting for Paul anymore.
Well, we definitely changed lenses on part two. So we went to slightly longer lenses and removed ourselves away from these characters a bit more. That was a deliberate choice. And whilst it'd be a very easy story to tell you that we went longer and longer and longer, it felt like the longer the lenses were, the more kind of characteristically iconic he became. So, like, there are scenes of him going into down to the south. And that was very much a throwback to, I mean, Lawrence of Arabia. You know what I mean? Like it's, I mean, I'm sure we would have used that lens even if Lawrence hadn't used it, because it's such a good lens, but they'd come up with the idea first, and it wasn't a homage or a throwback or anything like that. It was more of just like, this is the best lens to show this character, this foreigner in this land,
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business and sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
If you're a facilities manager at a warehouse and your HVAC system goes down, it can turn up the heat, literally. But don't sweat it, Grainger has you covered. Grainger offers over a million industrial-grade products for all your operations, including warehouse HVAC maintenance. And even better, they offer access to experts and fast delivery, so you and your warehouse can both keep your cool. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I'm wondering about the practicalities of dealing with all of the sand that you guys had to deal with, just like in terms of protecting the lenses and the camera equipment and all that stuff. Like, I mean, it may seem like a silly question, but how do you deal with that?
No, it's not a silly question, because the thing is that we go through, like, if we're not careful, we'll destroy equipment. And so what it means is that our cameras are almost continually bagged. And if you see any behind the scenes stuff, particularly on part one, because it was probably just more wind, a lot of the time the camera is bagged up. Because, and then if it's bagged up, it doesn't get any air. So my camera assistants have had to build little ventilation systems in it and hoses, and it's really quite a work of art, actually, what they've done.
Wow.
But yeah, at the end of every day, the equipment goes back to the truck in a clean environment. It's cleaned, all the sand gets out of it. Because yeah, you get a bit of sand in a lens, that doesn't pull focus very clean, and you destroy the lens, or you're going to send it back to London or something to fix. But so yeah, it required a lot of R&D to make sure that everybody kept these cameras clean.
Wow.
And think about it, because there's also times where we're sliding behind Paul, as he's sliding down, a sand dune to try and catch onto the sandworm. I mean, those cameras copped a face of sand, so
Do you know how many you
they did
went
well.
through over the course of the movie?
Well, I don't think we destroyed a camera. We would have definitely sort of replaced filters, 100%. We would have, but we had great filters. From a really strong filters. I don't know. We had a great. This is where doing part one was useful, because we had a massive dress rehearsal. It was almost like part one was a big rehearsal for part two. So I felt like we'd kind of found our stride in part two.
Excellent. News came out a little while back that the Batman Part 2 has been delayed until 2026, and one of my colleagues at work was wondering if that means that now you might have time to reunite with Gareth Edwards on the new Jurassic World movie that he's making.
So let me tell you, obviously, I wish I could talk about things like Batman and stuff like that, but I can't. So actually, I can't talk about anything. This is the problem. I can't talk about anything.
Fair enough, fair
I
enough.
wish I wish I could I wish I could. But I caught up with Gareth recently and said hi to him, and been talking a lot to him, because we've been doing a lot of chat about the creator as well. So yeah.
Excellent. Okay, so back to Dune Part 2. There's a really great shot where Chani and Paul have just taken down an ornithopter, and the two of them are running from right to left, and the exploded parts of
Oh
the
yeah.
vehicle crash down behind them and blow up even more. How much of that shot specifically is like visual effects? How much, if any of it, is miniatures? Can you walk me through that moment? Because I love that scene.
So that's a cool scene, because it was a very, very well planned scene. As in, it required a lot of planning. Whether it was well planned or not, I can't say, but it was required a lot of planning, given where the sun was, because it all relies on shadows. Like, that whole scene relies on, when they're in the shadow of the ornithopter, of the harvester, they're safe. And then we're under the shadow of the legs, they're safe. Because if they can't get shot if they're in under the legs, and that's the shadow. So it all relied on that. So what we had on that scene, we had massive legs attached to excavators. So we had two or three excavators, I think, with legs that would move, and these weren't little things like my hands. These are things that the size of a kind of a house, a small house, really. And so they were hiding underneath them, and then, it would come and hit, and I'd land underneath it. Like, there was a lot of power. And so that scene, that shot particularly, them running, the legs were 100% correct, 100% real. They're running from one leg to another leg as the leg's moving, I believe. And the explosion was real. I'm sure it was augmented, because that's what our great friends in the VFX department do. But obviously, we couldn't crash an ornithopter. So I would, yeah, the ornithopter is something that is pretty CG.
Is that I guess the way to phrase this would be like shooting something like that, would that be a plate? Is that a whole separate unit of just another unit that you would have to delegate tasks to in order to film particular action beats that are going to be then be composited into larger shots, or is that something that you m oversee more directly yourself?
Well, I mean, if it's the actors running, that was fully a main unit shoot. like, because, you know, and then with the explosion and the, you know, we, but what would have happened was we would have done some more explosion plates so that they would have been able to sort of enhance the explosion. Because obviously there was a limit to amount the explosion near actors and a film crew. So, you know, we shot other explosions that would have been used to amp that one up. In terms of the ornithopter crashing, I don't think we did any model work on that. So that wasn't a model. That was, I think that was CG. But the CG models, though, I mean, the 3D CG models are getting so good now. That, I mean, I personally, not to say there's no room for real models now, but CG 3D models are getting really, really good.
I think I have like 30 seconds left with you, but I just wanted to ask about miniatures. Is that something that you relied on, just more broadly speaking, across the making of this movie at all?
No, not really. I mean, we had some miniature things. We Aaliyah was a model, you know, and you know, Aaliyah was probably a bigature actually, because Aaliyah was, you know, probably bigger than a miniature. And so, but we did create those models for both those states that the character's in.
Cool. All right. Well, I'm out of time with you, but Greg, this has been so great. And thank you so much. And congratulations on doing part two. It's amazing.
Thanks, Ben. Good to chat to you, mate.
All right. That's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find much more about Dune Part 2 at slashfilm.com. I will try to link to a couple things in the show notes as well. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features that you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. That's bpearson @slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That genuinely does help us out a lot. And tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow.
At Nutrafol, we don't just help your hair, we help your body grow it. Because it's never just about your hair. It can be your job or your deodorant or your lunch or just normal life. That's why our whole body approach targets the key root causes of hair thinning. Discover your root causes and why we're the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement brand at Nutrafol.com. That's Nutrafol.com. These statements have not been approved by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease paid for by Nutraceutical Wellness, Inc.